You are listening to a sermon by Evan Kreider, recorded on Sunday, July 4th, 2010, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or be distributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I'm going to be speaking on the passage from 2 Kings 5, so I would recommend that if you're listening on internet, you open your Bibles to 2 Kings 5, and if you're here with us, you can follow along. Read each verse to yourself as I'll talk about it, and I won't read the verses per se, but I'll give background and comments on each. The background for verse 1 of chapter 5, we have to remember that the king of Aram and the king of Israel have been fighting off and on, more or less annually, for a very long time. It was such a common thing that in 1 Kings 20, they said there was a 3-year peace between these two guys. So they're fighting constantly. Naaman was a victorious army commander for the kingdom of Aram, and his credited sort of with God giving the victories, the military victories to Aram. This is the viewpoint of the compilers, editors, and writers of the Book of Kings. It's basically a history of the monarchy of Israel. I would view it as propaganda. Is trying to support the monarchy, buttress it. The monarchy paid for the temple. The temple supports the monarchy. It reminds me very much of medieval France, with the Catholic Church and the government working hand in glove. And the writers then try to portray, if you're successful, it's because you're following God. If you're not successful, it's because you're not following God. And so they're trying to reconcile temple and government in throughout this. And they even use these lenses when they're viewing pagan military forces. So they don't attribute victories to superior arms, the use of iron. They don't attribute it to superior numbers of forces or tactics. God is what's behind it. That's just the view they have. In the same way, this mighty warrior suffers leprosy. And it was not an uncommon view to believe that if you had a very serious illness, it was thanks to God. This is the view of the ancients. It's not my view, and it's not your view. But we understand. In verse 2, raids are the most common problem between the neighboring tribes. Both the Arameans and the Jews would frequently steal animals from each other. They would burn each other's crops. Sometimes they would enslave people. These people did not get along then. They do not get along now. In verse 3, we need to remember that people tended to see slaves as being inferior in every way. They were almost subhuman. Remember, Christians in the United States viewed slaves as 3/5 of a person. So this person, this unnamed girl of little stature in society, remembered stories from her home when she saw the suffering of her master, and she offered all the help that she could give, information which might possibly lead to a cure. Naaman was so desperate that he and his family were willing to try alternative medicine, if you will, even risking going to a foreign country without the guarantee of a safe conduct. Now, this story is grouped together with stories about King Ahab, and yet it's interesting in this story or this legend, the king is never mentioned by name. I'm going to end up calling him Ahab. I like Ahab about as much as I like Maradona. So anytime there's something bad about them, I I remember that. Verse 5, the storyteller has Naaman taking an unbelievable amount of wealth along to get cured. My commentary said that the silver, for instance, would be about 750 pounds of silver. We, on the market, think of silver in terms of ounces. So even back then, people assumed that private health care could be exorbitantly expensive. Verse 7, the unnamed king of Israel assumes that Naaman's visit is just another pretext for yet another of their military skirmishes, and he does not know what to do. Verse 8, finally, the stage is fully set. The monarch and the monarch's government are at an impasse, and so it's time to introduce Elisha into the story to solve the king's problems. Verse 9 and 10, Elisha himself does not meet Naaman or greet him, but through a mere servant instructs Naaman to perform a strange ritual, something totally unlike that which he expected. Number 7 is often part of rituals. In verse 11, Naaman is furious at being snubbed. Well, I have to confess, sometimes I see myself through very peculiar lenses, to use Henry's phrase several weeks ago, and I think I'm quite special, and that the customs with which I grew up are the best customs, and the manners are the best. And when people vary from those expectations in social interchange, I really think they're not doing it quite right. Fortunately, Naaman had good advisors, servants with level heads, men who knew how to get through to him. I think they probably had to do this on numerous occasions. Verse 14, in order for our story to succeed, Naaman must cooperate. So he does, and all is well. He is miraculously healed with Elisha in absentia. The absence of Elisha makes it clear to the listeners of this story that God did the healing. Elisha did not even come out and say good morning. When he bathed in the dirty Jordan River, Naaman most likely did not believe in Yahweh. By now, he likely did not believe in Elisha's powers. The way the story is told, Naaman would have been a true skeptic. Nobody, according to this story, would have been more surprised by the cure than Naaman himself. In 15, verse 15, the story changes. And in a sense, Naaman is shown as converting to monotheism. In verse 16, since Elisha did nothing, God did the healing, Elisha cannot accept payment in good conscience. In verse 17, Naaman says, essentially, well, he assumes that Yahweh is in part a local god, and that any sacrifices offered to Yahweh must be done somehow on Yahweh's soil. And verse 18, finally, is the crux of this for me. Before I read it to you, I'll just say that Reuben was the god of thunder and storms. And the main temple to Reuben was in Damascus, where Naaman and the kingdom of Aram were. And later the Romans came, and that temple was taken down, and a greater temple was built to the Zeus, their leading god. And then, much later, that temple came down, and there's now a mosque on that very same place where Naaman went to worship the god Reuben. Often a locality becomes sacred in people's minds. Let's read verse 18. Naaman says in 17 that he is going to offer sacrifices only to God from now on. But may the Lord pardon your servant on one count. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow down in the house of Rimmon, when I do bow down in the house of Rimmon, may the Lord pardon your servant on this one count. Elisha said to Naaman, go in peace. Whether this miracle story literally happened as told, or whether it is essentially another of the urban legends about Elisha, we have to ask ourselves, why was the story told? Why was this story eventually put into the written record of the monarchy? And why should we pay any attention to it? So I have a number of reflections in no particular order, except the last one's the longest. First, the story tells us that Elisha viewed Naaman not as a powerful or wealthy general, not as a foreigner, not as a non-Jew, not as a pagan, but Elisha thought of Naaman as a human being who had leprosy. By contrast, the unnamed king of Israel, I like to think King Ahab, saw Naaman as a five-star general from an enemy country, a military threat, someone to be feared. Another thing I notice in this story is that God works through the small people. The unnamed slave girl, the servant, who later in the story is going to disobey, and with an unusual prophet. There was a big debate about this prophet during his lifetime. Was he real or was he not the real McCoy? He was not in the payroll of the monarchy, and so that puts a shadow over him. He was not associated with the temple, with Jerusalem, and that puts a cloud over him. On the other hand, while God worked through the small people, God in this story did not work through the king. He did not work through the government. And it's portrayed this way in a book about government, about kings, the monarchy. And since the monarchy's view of the situation was incorrect, the analysis of the situation had to be wrong, and they could not arrive at a useful decision. Another thing I notice is that God's healing was a gift. Elisha did not place any religious conditions on Naaman other than to undergo the bizarre ritual of washing in the Jordan River. Elisha did not require Naaman to change religion, to admit monotheism was good. He did not ask him to give up fighting the Jews. He did not ask him to return the Jewish slave girl. Nothing was required except accepting the gift of healing and showing that acceptance by bathing. Now, the Jews hearing this story may well have wondered why their God, and even someone they were coming to think of as the leading prophet of this God, did not require conversion, circumcision, dietary adherence, or adherence of any of the religious rituals in order to be blessed by their God Yahweh. Might this be the way their God was looking on their present captors in Babylon? And fourth, Naaman makes one absolutely fascinating request. He tells Elisha that even though he now sees there's only one God, and even though he's only going to make sacrifices to this one God on the God's soil, he, Naaman, is still going to walk with his king and bow with the king before the king's favorite idol in the temple to that idol. And Naaman hopes that this forced formality will be acceptable to Elisha and his God. And Elisha's answer is profound. Go in peace. But what might this have meant to the Jews, hearing the story being told and retold to them, especially while living in exile, deep in the surrounding culture of foreign gods, foreign idols, foreign ways? I follow the line of scholarship that argues that the book of Deuteronomy was pulled together and then later edited at about the same time as the history of the monarchy was being compiled and then later edited. And the conclusion of this story concerned the very sort of compromise the whole book of Deuteronomy sought to prevent. Believers blending into the surrounding pagan cultures and participating in them. I now pause to remember J. Lawrence Burkholder. J. Lawrence Burkholder passed away 9 days ago in Goshen, Indiana. I last shook his hand when he came to see our family when Dad passed away 6 months ago. Little known in Western Canada, J. Lawrence Burkholder was a leading Mennonite intellectual. As far as I know, he was the only Mennonite to hold a chair in the Harvard Divinity School. And he made a profound impression there. Dad worked with J. Lawrence when J. Lawrence later became president of Goshen College for 14 years, guiding that leading Mennonite college of the day in significant ways. In part, J. Lawrence Burkholder argued that the Anabaptist theology of radical descent has severe limitations, particularly once you leave Mennonite communities. He knew from experience as a relief worker in China during the turbulent rise of communism, and from his experiences at Harvard, and yes, administration at Goshen, he knew that the real world forces people to make what Burkholder called tragic decisions, compromises which go against your very fiber. Burkholder also argued that there really is ambiguity. Burkholder wrote in his book, The Limits of Perfection, "I felt that there was more to Christianity than could be contained within the idea of the isolated Mennonite community and the theology of descent." And when he was looking over his life and giving a talk about it, he said, "And when it comes to ambiguity, I contended that the world is a sea of good and evil, multiple demands, three-way obligations, triage, making tragic necessity inevitable. For Christians experience genuine dilemmas, not just seeming dilemmas." This story about Elisha reminds me of the thinking and writing of J. Lawrence Burkholder. The secular world of power and politics at times has options, each of which seems fatally flawed and dead wrong. In this world of genuine dilemmas, Elisha did not ask obedient Naaman to convert openly, or to build a new altar, or to stop entering temples of idols, or to change his job, or even to stop raiding Jewish settlements. Elisha, for whatever reason, went so far as to accept the deceitful compromise proposed by Naaman. Are there, in the real world, supposed to be two standards for believers. One standard for those born into a religion, and another standard for the new converts. In a sense, Paul seemed to think so. He essentially argued that Jewish Christians should continue living as devout Jews, being utterly distinct from Greek society. And at the same time, Paul's new Greek converts were allowed to blend into their pagan society, ignore Jewish rituals and regulations. They could even attend banquets in the rented dining halls of pagan temples. Just how flexible is our religion, our faith? This is a question which we answer over the generations. And we answer it in different ways. Janice and I, for example, both descend in part from Amish ancestry. We descend from hardworking believers who fiercely desire to follow God in all ways. Our Amish ancestors decided, in part, that this total obedience surely involved a clear separation from secular society. Janice's ancestors and mine finally left the Amish world and became what were called Old Mennonites. Mennonites adhering to many of the old ways. In fact, the last meeting of the Amish bishops was held in Janice's ancestral barn. And at that meeting, they could not reach a compromise. And so after that meeting, Mennonites divided from the Amish in Ohio. Many years later, Janice's life and mine have now moved even farther from that world. At many points, our world has become uncomfortably close to the world of Naaman. And as it gets that way, we hope that our God will be as understanding with us as he apparently was with Naaman, the obedient believer who, though filled with gratitude and new belief, nevertheless felt forced to compromise with pagan society. As we seek to live our lives of obedience, our lives of faith, may God be with us. May we somehow have the fresh new faith of a Naaman and the wisdom of an Elisha, so that we too may go in peace as we live lives of faith surrounded by our pagan society.